May it please the court, Jonathan Marks for the appellant Kelly Webb. We're here this morning basically from the appellant's perspective to focus on two points within the brief. Specifically, the main emphasis is in point one, the focus on section 452.455.4 and its interpretation. Basically, in point one of our brief, we've asserted that the trial court erred in modifying the consent judgment of April 12, 2004 for the reason that pursuant to Missouri Revised Statute 452.455.4, the trial court lacked jurisdiction to entertain father's motion to modify consent judgment, and that father had a past due child support arrearage in excess of $10,000, but failed to post a bond in the amount of the arrearage prior to filing his motion to modify. The section states that when a person filing such a petition for modification of a child custody decree, owes past due child support to a custodial parent in an amount in excess of $10,000, such person shall post a bond in the amount of past due child support owed as ascertained by the Division of Child Support Enforcement or reasonable legal fees of the custodial parent, whichever is greater before the filing of the petition. The court then holds that bond in escrow until the modification proceeding pursuant to the section is complete, wherein the bond is transmitted to the Division of Child Support Enforcement and then distributed to the custodial parent pursuant to the order of the trial court.
But no bonding company is going to give money. I mean, you just have to, I mean, if you're putting a bond for this amount of money, someone's going to collect that money to pay the overdue child support.
That is the purpose of the statute, Your Honor, is that subsequently the individual who is in arrears prior to subsequently coming in and requesting that custodial change is to do that prior to the filing of the motion to modify to ensure the rights of the receiver.
But there's no hearing? I mean, it's basically a bar to filing. It's not like you'd have a hearing and say, I owe it, I don't owe it, I can't afford it, I couldn't afford it 6 months ago, I didn't have an attorney, I couldn't. There's no explanation. It's just an absolute bar on filing the petition.
I don't know if I'd call it a bar. I certainly would call it a condition precedent that somebody has to comply with prior to coming into the trial court and filing that motion to modify. I mean, it's whether you look at it as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction or you take it as a matter of jurisdictional competence. Either way, the person has to subsequently be able to look at it for the ability to comply with that section of the statute, that they have to do that to be able to get into court and have
where
the ability
to do that.
Where in the
statute does it say the word jurisdiction?
It does not state the word jurisdictional competence within the statute, Your Honor. That was an interpretation by the Eastern District as argued the first time that it took it to the extent. When argued originally, we argued that it was pure subject matter jurisdiction, that the Western District, who had already received just one case at the time of the arguing of our original appellate argument, was basing it on Miller. Miller was the first case within the state of Missouri to actually interpret this particular statute. Within Miller, which was a little bit different factually from this case, the individual had subsequently filed the motion to modify, the mother filed the motion to dismiss, it was granted, and then the father took the motion back up on appeal.
How do we know under this statute that the parent owes support in excess of $10,000? How is that finding made, and by whom is it made?
Well, it's as ascertained by the Division of Child Support Enforcement. In this particular case, the payor.
So you want to delegate what is in effect. You might want to make their finding or their determination to be unreviewable by a court.
Well, it doesn't state that it's unreviewable, Your Honor.
Is it not reviewable?
Well, sure, it would be reviewable if the man posted, in this particular case, posted the bond.
But what if he didn't have the money to post the bond? He would never be able to get it reviewed, or she, if it were the spouse.
Or even have a day in court.
And add to that when you respond, if you would.
Yes, Your Honor.
If he just wanted to challenge the support amount, he can do that without posting a bond, correct?
He absolutely could do that. There could have been a separate motion, wherein he filed a motion for the determination of the arrears sum certain. He could have appeared before the trial court at that point in time prior to filing his motion to modify and had his day in court.
So he had an avenue for a hearing to determine the amount owed in court.
He absolutely does at any point in time. And that could have been done prior to the filing of the motion to modify.
Didn't both parties agree to different amounts, but both amounts were over $10,000?
That is correct, Your Honor. And at the time that the motion was filed, The amount, as determined pursuant to the exhibit submitted by father at trial, was in excess of $12,000, almost $13,000 at that point.
The idea being, if you haven't attacked the amount, in effect you are contemptuous of the prior judgment by refusing to comply with it and pay the custody you're owed. And when that gets up to a certain level, if you want the benefit of modifying that, you need to show respect for the judgment in the first instance by paying it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I would agree with that interpretation, that the purpose of the statute, unlike what my opponent stated within his brief, is really to enforce the public policy of the state, which is to prevent someone who is not complying with court orders and who subsequently could be charged with felony non-support to walk into a trial court and attempt to change the custodial rights that have been set forth in a custody judgment and avoid his responsibilities or her responsibilities, depending upon the pay or
prior to coming to court. Under the Hendricks case, it's clearly not personal jurisdiction, and clearly a court is subject matter jurisdiction of a motion to modify. Certainly Hendricks and other cases are a bit confusing as to what else is out there and what it's left. Why is there this attempt to put it in a subject matter or personal jurisdiction category? Why not just address the authority of the court and whether we can waive a statutory requirement, regardless of whether it's jurisdictional?
I think that the basis, the fact that the original interpretation as it came down, when you're dealing with it within the trial court, it's usually presumed that somebody is going to raise it at that level. The knowledge base is either raised by the individual who is filing it or by the opponent once their client is served. Until it subsequently went up for the interpretation first in Miller, I don't think anybody had to really think about that because typically it was raised in the trial court. And here, as a result of it not being raised in front of Judge Page originally, we resulted in the situation where it had to be raised on appeal for the first time. I would agree that it certainly should be an absolute, it's just a matter of clear interpretation on the four corners of the statute. It's a shall, it's not a may. It's no different than the residency requirement of having to be a resident of the state of Missouri for a period of 90 days prior to being able to file your dissolution of marriage action.
So why didn't it just error by the trial court as opposed to a jurisdictional issue?
It certainly could be, Your Honor. I wouldn't disagree with that. I would certainly agree that the duty of it, that it certainly was an error on the trial court from that perspective, and it also could be interpreted that it failed to interpret the statute as being a bar to that individual. Once the trial court certainly became aware of the fact through testimony or through the exhibit that was submitted and admitted into evidence, that at that point in time, the trial court certainly should have just stopped the proceedings and stated that they had no ability to go forward based upon the fact there was no compliance with the statute.
If it's error, then it has to be preserved to be raised on appeal.
If from that argument, yes, Your Honor.
So do you have case law that would support your position that if we find it is not jurisdictional because it is a matter of authority rather than jurisdiction, do you have case law that says that that is an error that can be raised on appeal for the first time and does not have to be preserved?
There's no case law that I'm aware of, Your Honor, which I think is the purpose of when you are looking at this statute, instead of focusing the entire argument on whether or not it's purely trial court error, which is why I think Miller went into the personal jurisdiction argument and then subsequently was also done in Roach. I think you do have to look at it as to the interpretation of the statute and either make a determination that it falls within the category of subject matter jurisdiction or it falls within the category of jurisdictional because if you fail to do that, it does leave it upon the onus of, in this case, her prior trial counsel. But the problem, and I think the reason you don't want to go down that path, is a very simple one. The burden originally is not upon the individual who's getting served the motion to modify. The burden, the way the statute is read, is upon the individual filing the motion. So to do what you're asking, you better start then with the error occurring from the individual who signs the affidavit and filing his motion to modify, the individual upon the trial counsel who subsequently files it, knowing presumably that his client is in arrears more than $10,000, then you're getting to the trial court. So I think that it is better for this court to interpret it as either being subject matter jurisdiction or jurisdictional competence to avoid that, because it would be skirting the burden that is put upon the individual and the lawyer that are filing the original motion to modify, and then putting the burden on the individual who didn't receive the subsequent child support and is, you know, $10,000 more short.
Are huge, though, to your argument, because there are any number of statutes that make statutory requirements to go forward. And so you're saying anytime any statutory requirement isn't met, then the court has no authority to adjudicate the issue, and the opposing party has no obligation to raise that issue in the trial court.
I don't believe that that's the manner in which this statute is drafted. I think that if you look at it from a different perspective, for example, I would agree with you on that line, which follows personal jurisdiction. If you looked at it as someone filing a divorce, serving a spouse out of state, within the petition they pled property or maintenance issues, and then it is certainly upon the burden of that individual to raise in a response of pleading pursuant to Rule 55 whatever their affirmative defenses are, or at least participate pursuant to what the Eastern District said in Burke versus Hutto, or else they've waived them. But here, this isn't that. This is the ability of how you get into the court to allow the court to have the authority to subsequently rule on your request for child custody modification. It doesn't bar you from getting into court. It doesn't bar you from doing things. I'm sorry.
To go back to a question that Judge Fisher asked a while ago, you could start with a motion to modify the support obligation. Why wouldn't it be appropriate for, as the trial judge did in this case, she heard the evidence as it related to the best interests of the child and so forth and so on, and then also at the same time heard evidence related to the child support obligation, which she found the recalculated arrearage shall be $0.
Well, there's two.
Is there something wrong with that?
There is something wrong with that, Your Honor. I mean, first of all, it skirts the ability to comply with the statute. I mean, if somebody is really...
Yeah, but doesn't Judge Fisher's motion to modify the amount of the arrearage, doesn't that skirt the statute as well?
Well, no, it does not. And factually, you can answer it on two levels. Just on a pure legal level as to what you ask, you can file at any point in time a motion to determine sum certain. He did, that sum was already determined in two proceedings prior to ever getting into this. The case history is very clear. The original judgment had that at $10,900. Then there was a motion to modify. Neither time did anyone challenge what that arrearage was, and it became a sum certain. So he was unable to then come back and file a third motion requesting it because he would have been barred from point in time in September of 2005 going back. So he had no recourse. So now what you're doing is you're allowing an individual to come into court, not complying with their order, not going into court and using the ability to file a motion to determine whether that arrearage was proper during the proper time limits, and then bootstrap it to a motion to modify to have the ability to avoid 455.4, and you shouldn't be allowed to do that. Otherwise, we have no point in why you should have to comply with 410 at all as to what the reasons are and the basis are for filing a motion to modify. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We, as Mr. Marks noted, we have a number of issues before the court this morning concerning custody and child support. And however, with all due respect, Judge Teitelman, and your greater understanding of mathematical concepts, it's the intersection of child custody and support that brings us here today. 452-455 involves the question is, at least as drafted in the briefs, are we talking about subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction? Unfortunately, as lawyers, we have the tendency to think within certain boxes, and that's how it's been presented to us from Miller and Roach and in the Eastern District. But the real question is, if we go down the road of subject matter jurisdiction, are we infringing upon the duty of the child court to determine the best interest of the child, as you, Judge Wolf, noted in the prior argument? That's what's before the trial court, is a determination of what's in the best interest of the child.
And have you read the Hendricks case?
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
And it was pretty, it's a little bit unclear how to deal with these jurisdictional competence or statutory requirement kind of cases, but it was very clear those were not matters of either subject matter or personal jurisdiction. So are you saying we should overrule it to the extent that they said, you look at whether a court has competence to hear a kind of case, clearly it can hear dissolution cases and motions to modify and so forth, so it has subject matter jurisdiction. That's a different issue than whether or not statutory requirements are met. But it was really clear it's not subject matter or personal jurisdiction.
Are you asking whether I think that Hendricks should be overruled?
Well, in effect, if you're saying we should treat it as, if I understood you, maybe I misunderstood. I thought you were saying we have to put it back into a category of either subject matter or personal jurisdiction.
No, I was discussing it in terms of how the case was briefed and how the prior decisions in the Western District and the Eastern District have assessed it. Unfortunately, as lawyers, we have a tendency to put our blinders on.
It's a very confused area, and the cases are not all consistent.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. And I think Judge Breckenridge, your comment about is this an issue in which if a statutory requirement is not met, do we put people in a situation where even if it's not raised in the trial court, is it in some way, shape, or form defective and depriving the trial court of the authority to act or jurisdiction or anything along those lines? The legislature has put one requirement here. There's a lot of other requirements, paying filing fees, and various allegations that need to be made. I would suggest that this is something, whether it's called personal jurisdiction, jurisdictional competence, or even subject matter jurisdiction, because even in Roche, talked about subject matter jurisdiction having the ability to be waived. I didn't quite understand that, but there was a mention of that in the Roche case. It would seem as if it has to be brought up by the opposing party in the trial court, and especially under the facts of this case.
So all of our statutes that impose requirements for filing suit and that impose, let's say certain elements have to be proved and so forth, should have a little asterisk that say unless the other party doesn't raise it? I mean, none of those are jurisdictional prerequisites or automatically disqualifying. All of those are waivable, and the burden is always on the defendant to raise them. Doesn't that present some...
I hesitate.
Some lack of respect for the elements and for the provisions of a statute enacted.
I hesitate to speak in absolutes. And so without knowing what particular set of circumstances we're dealing with and what particular statutory requirement, I would hesitate to hazard a guess as to whether it should be all one way or all the other in every single case.
Now, one thing that's distinct is also it's financial. There's many different requirements that where the impoverished or disadvantaged. For example, if there's non-lawful detainer, if you lose non-lawful detainer action, then in order to keep yourself, if it's all about possession of property, in order to keep yourself in the property and not get evicted, you have to come up with a bond, twice the amount of the rent, and keep that coming, or else you're not in possession to appeal, or you can't appeal the ruling, you're done. Or in a case of an injunction, for example, if you can't come up with the bond required by the court, you're out of court. So there are a lot of issues where money is a requirement. And this is, the legislature seems to have been saying this is a situation which you have to pay up in order to pay to play.
And I think there are two issues that or two areas or issues that distinguish it from, say, an unlawful detainer or something along those lines. First of all, we have the best interest of the child. We have a situation here where the trial court heard evidence for 4 days with regard to the best interest of these two particular children.
Legislature's saying the best interest of the child is served by someone who can afford and pays child support.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor. But in this particular case, it was mom that put the boat in the water and started the whole process by sending the serial notices of relocation. So we have a problem there. Either dad, who's behind on child support, and keep in mind in this particular case, the initial arrearage was not something that was accumulated after an initial judgment. There was a determination as to what dad's child support obligation was and said, okay, it's retroactive to
this
date.
Why does that matter?
Well, I think for purposes of determining whether whether this is something that he consciously allowed to accrue or got hit with and then started working on. I mean, you know, there really wasn't a whole lot of evidence, and I think the evidence was that he wasn't that much further behind, and it essentially complied with $1,090 a month from the time of the judgment forward.
But the court had reviewed a prior motion to modify by him and said, no, you owe this. Is that right?
There were custody issues. And I think he raised an issue with regard to the child support in terms of trying to undo that, and then he wasn't allowed to pursue that.
So how did the court retroactively say he owed no money when he'd owed over $10,000?
Well, in our point on that, I think unfortunately this could be a situation where it was kind of close enough for government work. I think what Judge Page was trying to do was, if you look at the numbers, and we've gone through them in the brief, if you only give Mr. Wickescala a 10% visitation credit for the almost 2 years that this case was pending, and use Judge Page's numbers in terms of the child support calculation, there's about a $500-something difference per month between what his obligation was and what he should have been paying while the case was pending. Right. And if she made that retroactive to the date of filing of all of this, you end up with about a $9,000 difference.
Right.
And the arrears was about 10.
Right.
So it was close. And I think that's what she was trying to do. And I've asked that if that's the problem, that it be remanded to Judge Page, in essence, to show her work.
Wasn't that prior amount of arrears determined as a sum certain, and wasn't that done in the form of a judgment by the court?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
So then why aren't the parties bound by that figure?
And Judge Page wasn't trying to do that. She was starting from that number.
And
saying from the time she filed, or that this case got started a few months later when Mom filed her notice of relocation and we started this whole process again.
The issue is that original arrearage was an arrearage that occurred between the time the original petition for dissolution was filed and the ultimate judgment. So right out of the chute, he had a $10,000 arrearage because she determined he didn't pay child support pending the litigation. And then what happened again was she determined that under the facts and circumstances, even though the amount clicked, it should have been less. And so at the end of the day, she wasn't saying that the arrearage wasn't right. It's that the arrearage was correct, but during the pendency of this litigation, he caught up because he learned his lesson and he paid what he was told.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But why isn't this, whatever label we give it, why isn't the filing of a bond a prerequisite to asking the court to relook at all these things? And the legislature clearly intended it to be. What authority do we have to ignore that?
I think for a number of reasons, Your Honor. And again, it's fact specific to this case, but in this particular case, this action was brought because of the notices of relocation. Before 452.377 was amended to set up this relocation procedure, Mom would have had to file a motion to modify, saying, I want to go to California, I want to go to Montana, I want to go to Farmington, I want to cut back on Dad's time. And instead, all she had to do was send him a certified letter. If Dad opposed it, which he did in this case, on a sequential basis, he files a motion to prevent the relocation. It is then up to Mom, in this particular case, to prove that it's in the best interest of the child, to allow the move and the changes with regard to custody, and it's in good faith. Now, actually, I think Dad's attendant motions to modify are just adjuncts to his motions to prevent relocation. There were issues with regard to custody then before the court. Once custody's before the court, and Mom's asking as part of her relocation request, she's asking that Dad's time be cut back. And she testified to that and acknowledged that, and the parenting plans show that, because she wanted to be in California rather than in Missouri. Once the issue of the custody of the children is before the court, the issue of custody is before the court for all purposes. Van Gundy, Ashton, all of those cases indicate that the court has to make a determination in the best interest of the child. So Dad, in essence, is not so much filing a motion to modify as he's filing a counter motion to modify.
So if he had just filed if the spouse files a motion to modify, in essence, you want us to apply, or someone wants us to apply, the fact that they can't answer unless they pay the $10,000, so
I think that's the upshot of the results in the Eastern District, because that decision pretty much ignored the fact that there were these relocation requests and just said, well, you can't do that. As I read the Eastern District decision, I'm not sure whether that has now allowed Mom to move to California, because it's put Dan in a position where all that evidence on the best interest of the child goes away, and if that's the case, then Mom can just go. I don't think that's the intent. I certainly don't think that was the intent of the legislature. I think you have to read 452.377 in conjunction with 455.
I think it's pretty clear you need a court order, court approval, where there's been objection.
But the question is he even allowed to object?
I don't think that's the question.
Well, I think
I understand your statement that it's connected and the custody issues can't be separated.
Okay. Well, are you saying that he could have got the relief that he received without filing a motion to modify?
I think if he had filed a motion to modify off the bat, mom hadn't sent a motion or sent a notice of relocation, and he was the one that was putting the boat in the water. If mom doesn't raise the issue of the arrearage, and we go through trial, and the judge hears all the evidence on the best interest of the children and makes a determination, I think the trial court could have proceeded on his initial motion, motion to modify.
But what if all he had filed was an objection to the relocation?
Yeah, that's my question.
Oh, okay. I think if all he had done is filed the objection to the relocation, and given the fact that mom had put the issue of the best interest of the children at issue and had asked for a significant change in the parenting arrangement, not just we want to move Wednesday to Thursday night, but we want to be in California rather than in Missouri and all that other stuff. I think that the best interest of the children then being before the court, as noted in the Van Gundy case, I think it's all on the table, and I think the court has to make a determination as to what's in the best interest of the children, especially when you view the evidence here. There was never any objection to any of the evidence that was presented as to what was in the best interest of the children and trying to formulate a parenting plan that was in their best interest. There were objections to evidence based upon it being prior to the prior judgment.
If his spouse files a certification to move the child to California, in order to maybe change that to say, well, not only I don't want her to go to California, the child to go to California, I want the child to be with me 3 weeks in the summer, or I want the child to be with me more time, that would require much to modify on his part.
I think so, Your Honor. I think in essence that's what mom did here, because when she filed her response to the objection, she specified how she wanted the parenting plan to change, and she was looking not only for relocation but a reduction in dad's time. So she was looking to change the parenting arrangement.
Do you have any assistance for the court in trying to figure out what statutory requirements are waivable and what are not waivable?
I think here, Your Honor, the problem is how the Eastern District and the Western District have what their starting points are.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about there, just from this court as.
No, I understand that, Your Honor. I think where the Western District was coming from at heart is probably the best place to start, because they're saying, look, this is something that has to be raised by the other side. You know, many of the issues that situations that were raised by Mr. Marks are evident from the face of the document, that, you know, somebody comes in with a Tennessee decision and it has to be registered in order to modify it or something like that. But here, it wouldn't necessarily be evident that dad was behind or mom was behind.
I think opposing counsel was making a distinction between a statute that might set out certain requirements. For instance, the court, you know, when it enters its order, shall find that one is in the best interest of the child, two, that not a sexual offender, three, that the father or person paying child support is not more than $10,000 behind. It didn't do that. It didn't say this was one of the elements that it shall look at in entering its judgment. It made it a prerequisite to filing suit, and that gave it a heightened importance, clearly, to the legislature, because they said you shall not file this motion to modify unless you first show if you are over $10,000 behind in your child support. And that gave it a greater importance than simply making it a statutory fact-finding that had to be made. That it really put the burden on the person filing suit or filing the motion to modify to show they complied, as opposed to simply being something that the court determines based on the evidence later on.
If I realize I'm almost out of the boat lane here, like in Hunt for Red October, but the I think here, had Dad filed the motion initially, the motion to modify, I would agree with you that that's something that could potentially be put on to Father, even if it isn't raised. But here, we're in essence, he's catching. He's in essence filing a counter motion because of Mom putting the issue at play. I don't think you can then say, well, you still have to adhere to the $10,000 bond requirement when we're dealing with the issue of custody.
Thank you.
One more question.
And I'm even sorry. If the parties don't bring this up as an error at trial, can't a reviewing court sua sponte review this issue? Because isn't it similar to the situation where the statute requires, if there's been abuse or neglect of a child alleged, that the court shall appoint a guardian ad litem, and if the court fails to do so, can't that be corrected on review?
It can be corrected on review if, and under Rombach, I think in that particular case, if the issue comes up, then there has to be an objection to keep the evidence out. And then if that's overruled, then there has to be a request that the pleadings be amended to conform to the evidence. I think, Judge Price, you wrote that opinion. And so under that set of circumstances, that still comes up at the trial level. If none of that is done, if those hoops aren't jumped through at the trial level, then the appellate court would not have the authority to review the matter under that circumstances. It would have been waived at the trial.
And you don't
level.
Think the appellate court under these facts has any sua sponte right to correct this?
I think when you consider the best interest of I know it's a broken record, the best interest of the child, but you have a certain judicial economy issue. You've got 4 days of trial here, most of it concerning the what is in the best interest of these children. And the mother, who arguably is trying to keep the best interest of the children at the forefront as well, doesn't raise this as a disqualifying issue. Never once. And then we go through the entire process, and then we're going to say, at the appellate stage, Judge, we know you heard all the questions and the issues with regard to the best interest of the children, but now we're going to undo it because Dad, at the time of the filing, not now probably, but at the time of the filing, was behind with regard to his child support. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense, quite frankly. Thank you,
counsel.
May it please the court. Two quick points, and hopefully 3 minutes or less. I just want to follow up on opposing counsel's comment in regards to Dad having to respond because this case arises starting under 377 as a relocation case. They're two separate statutes, two independent actions. 377 clearly states how it works. She files, she mails, certified mail, the notice of relocation. He has 30 days to file his motion and affidavit to prevent relocation. She has 14 days to file her response, and you are ready to go in front of the trial court, and you have your hearing. Period.
What if she says in her motion, I have relocated to somewhere else, and I'm asking for permission for the children to go with me, and the trial court says no? Doesn't the trial court under the statutes, or does the trial court under the statute, have the ability to reorder custody and visitation?
She's not allowed to relocate under 377 under that scenario.
She can relocate anywhere she wants to. It's only a question whether the children can relocate.
She would be invited. If she had relocated with the children under your scenario.
With the children.
Are you saying by herself or with the children?
What I'm saying is frequently you will get a case where the parent says, I've relocated and I'm asking for permission for the children to relocate with me. So in those circumstances, don't the trial courts go forward and enter new orders of custody and visitation?
Not necessarily. At the end of that hearing, the court is going to make a very clear determination. Either the children are able to subsequently relocate with the parent, or they're not.
Right.
Now, can they amend a parenting plan at that point in time?
Without
a motion to modify. They can if the circumstances dictate. But that wasn't this particular situation. This is after this motion is pending, after the relocation notice was filed, he then subsequently files an independent action as a motion to modify, which also goes back to the point that I want to make that Judge Wolf inquired upon earlier, which had to do with the inquiry in regards to whether or not the trial court could have, during the motion to modify, just erase the arrearage. And the answer in the way that this case was pled is no. I mean, if you look at the face of the motion to modify, it doesn't even state the basis.
But the court didn't erase the arrearage. The court applied the amounts the court found had been overpaid in the 2 years the case was pending and offset the amounts that were owed, there's no point in both paying each other. They offset, right?
I don't know if I can't state that I agree, because the judgment doesn't necessarily state that, Your Honor. I mean, first, there has to be the ability that it was even pled, which it wasn't. But even assuming that the court had the competence to rule upon the issue, there's no mathematical computation that goes in that shows how the court came to that conclusion. But based upon the face of the pleading, it wasn't pled within the body of the petition. The court should have, again, never gotten that far within the interpretation, because it wasn't pled and nobody tried that by consent. So how does the court have jurisdictional competence?
Let me just talk about jurisdiction for a moment, because it seems to me that the sometimes the Court of Appeals talks about things as jurisdictional when they're not. But I refer to the Constitution, Article 5, Section 14. The circuit court shall have original jurisdiction over all cases and matters, civil and criminal, period. Subparagraph B of that section says, procedures for the adjudication of small claims shall be as provided by law, which means that the legislature can mess with the jurisdiction of small claims courts. Let me go to Section 17. Associate circuit judges may hear and determine all cases, civil or criminal, and all other matters as now provided by law for magistrate or probate judges, and may be assigned such additional cases or classes of cases as may be provided by law. Now, my point about that is that there is nothing in the Constitution that authorizes the legislature to define subject matter jurisdiction for the circuit courts, because the circuit courts have original jurisdiction over all cases and matters, civil and criminal. Now, the legislature can create causes of action, limit causes of action, do lots of stuff, but the question about jurisdiction is one, it seems to me, that it's a constitutional matter, unlike the federal courts, where jurisdiction is set by statute. That's why I was asking you about jurisdiction, and it's not in. I mean, it looks like the legislature tried to do it, but they were at least wise enough not to use the word jurisdiction.
So noted, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
End of lecture.